You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
I've worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, undercover, overseas. I've worked for the National Security Agency, undercover, overseas. So when they say I'm a low-level systems administrator, that I don't know what I'm talking about, I'd say it's somewhat misleading.
From Snowden to El-Sisi, we'll review the day's top news stories with Stuart Purvis and James Schneider here in the studio. Also coming up...
Excuse me, please.
Hi, sweet darling.
Excuse me, I don't have time for that.
Brazilians love their soap operas and football with equal measure. So what's a soap to do when the World Cup eats up the airwaves? We'll find out. Later on, we'll also check in with our correspondent in Athens and talk books with Robert Bound. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. But before any of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. At least 14 people, one of them an army general, have been killed when a Ukrainian military helicopter was shot down near the eastern city of Slavyansk. Ukrainian officials say the aircraft, which was carrying soldiers on their way to replace colleagues, was shot down using a Russian rocket-propelled grenade launcher. A spokesman for militants in the rebel-held stronghold say they're claiming responsibility. The security watchdog, the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, says it's lost contact with one of its teams of monitors near the city of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Denmark has one of its nationals among the four missing civilian observers, who it's believed are being held by armed separatists. OSCE Ukraine spokesman Michael Bochyrkiv says he's hopeful they'll soon be found.
We have not yet been able to re-establish contact with them. It's now been since Monday. Of course, as the days pass, we get more concerned. But we are using all of our contacts, high-level government contacts, diplomatic contacts, non-state actors on the ground, of which there are many, to re-establish contact with them. We believe they're fine, they're well, but of course the one thing we do want is to see them return to base in Donetsk.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has described the apparent honour killing of a woman by her family as totally unacceptable and has demanded action. Mr. Sharif has demanded to know why police apparently stood by while Farzana Parveen, who was 3 months pregnant, was stoned and beaten to death by her family in front of a Lahore court. Families of passengers on board flight MH370 say they've been left feeling helpless and angry after Australian officials announced recent acoustic pings came from a source unrelated to the missing aircraft. A US Navy official has claimed underwater signals detected in the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane came from a search boat or the ping detector itself. The pinger locator was towed by the Australian ship Ocean Shield to listen for underwater signals in the southern Indian Ocean in an area where satellite data indicated the plane went down. The passenger jet disappeared without trace on March the 8th on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Hundreds of people have taken to the streets in Paris in protest at the victory of France's far-right National Front, Front National Party, in the European elections. It's the first time the FN has won a national election in France. It's sending 24 MEPs to Brussels compared with only 3 elected in 2009. The party's leader, Marine Le Pen, says she'll fight what she calls crazy measures like votes for immigrants. Her party beat the ruling socialists of President François Hollande into third place. Young Communist Party member Anne Sabourin says that...
The youth are going in the streets in order to contest this party, which is not what they say. They are not what they say. They are not protecting the people. They are just dividing people, and they will not give a future to the youth. So I'm really happy to see them in the street today.
Provisional results from Egypt's presidential election show former military chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has won an overwhelming victory. Egyptian media is reporting he's gained more than 93% of the vote, with ballots from most polling stations counted. Turnout is expected to be about 46%, far lower than Mr. Sisi was hoping for as an endorsement. Islamist and some secular groups have boycotted the vote. Mr. Sisi deposed President Mohamed Morsi last July after mass protests. Official estimates show the US economy shifted into reverse in the first 3 months of 2014, shrinking by an annualized rate of 1%. It's the worst economic performance since the first quarter of 2011. The fall in output was blamed on an unusually cold and disruptive winter, one of the coldest in the US for 20 years, and a plunge in business investment. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. 1806 here in London, 1306 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Welcome back. My guests today are Stuart Purvis, Professor of TV Journalism at City University London and author of When Reporters Cross the Line, and James Schneider, Editor-in-Chief of Think Africa Press. Stuart and James, welcome to the programme. We're going to begin in Moscow, with a new interview aired by NBC in America between NBC anchor Brian Williams and Edward Snowden. Before we talk about it, let's hear some of it.
I've worked for the Central Intelligence Agency undercover overseas. I've worked for the National Security Agency undercover overseas. And I've worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency as a lecturer at the Joint Counterintelligence Training Academy, where I developed sources and methods for keeping our information and people secure in the most hostile and dangerous environments around the world. So when they say I'm a low-level systems administrator, that I don't know what I'm talking about, I'd say it's somewhat misleading.
Edward Snowden there. Stuart Purvis, before we talk about what he said in the interview, let's talk about the fact that there was an interview in the first place. NBC say this took months of negotiations. It took place in the Kempinski Hotel in Moscow. It lasted 4 hours, the whole thing. It's a bit of a journalistic coup for NBC, isn't it?
It is, and it's in the context of American media, it's a relatively brave decision by NBC. I mean, Snowden has appeared in bursts before. For instance, he did what we call an alternative Christmas message for Channel 4 here in the UK, but that was just a couple of minutes. And Brian Williams is a big deal in the States. He's one of the best-known anchors, and he kind of made quite a lot of it at the start of the interview. This is the first time you're going to get a proper look at Snowden on that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, he was making a big statement. NBC were making a big statement by running it. Did he say anything sort of stunningly new? I didn't think so. But on the other hand, it was a proper conversation with him. You got more of a sense of what the guy was like. I thought the clip you heard there were things he'd clearly been dying to say for a long time. He'd been getting kind of probably hot under the collar about, and this was his opportunity to say it. So I thought it suited a number of people. It suited NBC to have an exclusive. It suited him to be on a big platform, and it suited him to get a few things off his chest.
And James Schneider, what was interesting, I thought, was how Edward Snowden couched his actions and his work in terms of seeing himself as he said, you know, a patriot serving my country. Because a lot of people on the right in the US have said, this man's a traitor. Why did he go to China? Why is he in Russia? We can't trust him. And yet he was making it very clear that, no, look, I serve my country, and I felt that I couldn't do that any longer at the NSA.
Yeah, and this is the narrative which is starting to emerge the more we find out about him. So it's pretty consistent, I mean, understandably, with what Glenn Greenwald's written in his new book about how this all came out, and also there are a host of new revelations in that. The idea is that, he was greatly affected by 9/11, he tried to join the military, he broke his legs and therefore couldn't serve, and then tried to join the intelligence service, and then this is the kind of natural end point of being upset with what he saw. I think that's quite worrying for the US security establishment, given how large it's grown and how, as it becomes more computer and data intensive, it shifts to needing younger people in positions of authority and positions of power. And the younger generation may be more likely to engage in more of the type of things that Ed Snowden has done. And I think they are, the only thing that they're a bit lucky that he clearly wasn't a low-level person. It'd be much more worrying for the US, for the NSA, if he were a low-level person who could just walk out with God knows how many documents.
Well, exactly. And as we know, Stuart, from the Washington Post investigation a couple of years ago, there are as many as a million people in the US that have security clearance to read certain documents. But it was interesting that he talked about, you know, that he was at Fort Meade military base on 9/11, talked about his grandfather working inside the Pentagon on 9/11. Do you think that will change some perceptions of Snowden in the US?
I think people will feel a little better informed about him, and that, of course, is the benefit of doing these interviews for him. It's unintermediated. He's just kind of speaking it directly to people. They can just judge him as it is. So it says it was a human story, as opposed to a kind of loner who somehow ended up in Russia, which was a kind of, you know, the narrative that certainly the American military would have and defense organizations would have preferred. So to that extent, I thought he came across well. I think he still comes across a little bit naively in suggesting that, you know, he doesn't know of anything that any damage that was done to American security as a result. He quite rightly says, if there was something specific, nobody has told me what it is. But, you know, from my own background in dealing with, you know, certain information which comes to the media, and you're slightly second-guessing in truth the impact of it when you go with it, I think he can never really know in truth what actually is the impact of what he's done.
There has been quite a sort of an open process in terms of the way the New York Times and The Guardian and others that have used the material have actually, you know, gone to the security services on each occasion, said, look, this is what we're going to print. What are the potential problems?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not WikiLeaks, which is kind of publish and be damned. It's going, as you say, in Britain to something called the DA Notice Committee, which is a body which kind of gives advice on what might be a breach of national security. But there were releases before that process kicked in the very early days, which did not, if you like, go through that filter.
James Schneider.
And in the interview, he did say it's entirely possible that there were that it could have harmed in some way military intelligence in the US, but that there was no evidence of it, and that they're saying there's a huge amount with no evidence, which suggests that there hasn't been any.
Let's look at the reaction in Washington to this. John Kerry, James said, Edward Snowden needs to man up and come home, which was an interesting phrase. As Edward Snowden pointed out in this interview, under the 1917 Espionage Act, which it's possible he might be charged under, he can't make the public interest defence. So do we think we're any closer to a situation where he may end up coming home?
No, I don't think we're any closer to him coming home at all. I mean, clearly there's a lot of political animus towards him in the United States. And I think he would be foolish to come home without a lot of safeguards, which I doubt would be forthcoming right now.
OK, let's move on to the surprise election result in Egypt. We're confident we're going to call it. It's El-Sisi. He's won with 93.3% of the vote. You've got to admire that 0.3%. Stuart Purvis, are you surprised it wasn't higher?
Well, you know, when you've got a boycott by the opposition, you're bound to get a figure which is, you know, reaching almost farcical levels. I mean, it's not as bad as in the days of the Soviet elections where there was only one candidate, so they ended up at 99.9. In fact, Belarus still, you know, prides itself on those kind of elections. So I think the as interesting figure is the turnout, which is not as high as he wanted. You know, about half the people voted, actually higher than the number of people who voted in the British local and European elections last week. So from that point of view, it was a success. I thought he was naive, ever hoping to get up to sort of 80% turnout. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. And he does seem to say some things sometimes which kind of seem almost counterproductive from his own point of view. But in a sense, he didn't match the turnout when, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood were elected. So that's a failure on his part, certainly.
And it's interesting that it, James, that it went to a third day of voting, which it wasn't supposed to. And you had state media saying, "You, everyone must go out and vote. It's your democratic duty. It's your nationalistic duty. You must go out and do this."
Yeah, precisely. I mean, turnout across Europe in the European elections may not have been terribly high, but voting wasn't extended an extra day, and the media weren't saying that you were supporting the terrorists if you didn't go out to vote. I mean, I think we have to view this election entirely in the context of military takeover of large organs of the state, closing down media, closing down the space for the debate, and a return to, well, it's probably even worse than late Mubarak era elections and politics. And, you know, the labelling of the, you know, constant labelling of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorists is a dangerous trajectory for Egypt to go in.
And on that issue, that's something that both the military and the state media together have been deeply involved in organising.
Yes, and we've seen the mass convictions for for meant to be hanging of hundreds of people, and the state have arrested something like 30,000 people since July last year, and at least 1,000, but probably more than 1,000 people have been killed by state forces. Also, the other way, about 450 policemen have also been killed. So it's not like violence isn't begetting violence, but it's the violence is not going to end as long as such a significant portion of the Egyptian population and the organised bits of the Egyptian population are labelled totally anathema.
Stuart Purvis, the election, if we can actually call it an actual election, of El-Sisi, provides Western countries with a slight issue here, doesn't it? Because there had already been difficulties with the West about whether they were to recognise this man, because although he was probably more their kind of guy, he had led a coup, and we're supposed to be against that sort of thing. Does the fact that there has been an election mean that you think Western countries will see Sisi as the legitimate president?
I suspect that they will continue with the policy, which I think has applied to a number of countries, which were in favour of free and fair elections unless they get the wrong result, which we've seen, for instance, in Gaza when Hamas was elected and things like that. So, you know, the Western countries' commitment to democracy is highly qualified. And what they tend to do at the moment like is to kind of fall rather silent. And in a sense, when the coup first happened, there were all sorts of Western leaders, foreign ministers arriving in Cairo. Nothing much ever seems to have come of that. So that they basically will keep their heads down. But I think it's interesting what James said. In some ways, things are worse off than they were under Mubarak. The Muslim Brotherhood was, in a sense, fairly active towards the latter stages of his term. So it's curious how the things that the West welcomed so much were the end of Mubarak. They've stayed silent with actually things being arguably worse than they were under Mubarak.
Stuart Purvis and James Schneider, we'll leave it there for a moment. We'll be back in about a minute's time to talk about Iraq, of all things, and also Nigeria. Stay tuned.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Uh, And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Stuart Purvis and James Schneider are with me in the studio. Now, if you ever wanted to read the personal correspondence of two world leaders in the planning stages of a controversial war, well, you might still be waiting for a little while. The transcripts and full notes of conversations between Tony Blair and George W. Bush will remain secret, says the UK's Chilcot Inquiry into the Iraq War. But the gist... It says the gist of these conversations will be published. Stuart Purvis, this inquiry, the Chilcot inquiry, has lasted longer than the official part of the war itself. It's lasted longer than the run-up to the war seemed to last. At last, it seems like it might actually be published. What can we expect from it, and how important or otherwise were these conversations between Bush and Blair?
Well, today's announcement is clearly a compromise by the people holding the inquiry and the man who is effectively the chief of staff at 10 Downing Street, a man called Jeremy Hayward, who's a civil servant, but he's kind of, in his mind, he's representing prime ministers past and future by sort of saying, look, you simply cannot have open access to the communications between British prime ministers and foreign leaders. And the argument is, from his point of view, that it's not fair to foreign leaders as much as it's not fair to British prime ministers. So he didn't want, I mean, when the inquiry was initially announced, the people doing the inquiry were promised all kinds of access. But of course, what happens in reality is once they actually start asking for the documents, you know, the civil service kicks in, oh, you can have this, but you can't have that. So the compromise of, I think the quote is gists and quotes. Mm. In other words, they've done a compromise where they will be able to quote very shortly and very selectively from documents so that they can explain why they've come to certain conclusions. So they'll quote it almost in evidence, but you won't get the long transcripts, you won't get the, you know, the detailed memos and things like that. Frankly, it's better than nothing. But the problem is, from the Chilcot Inquiry's point of view, is it will leave so many questions open. Like, well, you know, what was the context of that quote? What, you know, what else was said in that document? So I suppose having had this this kind of stalemate lasting nearly 3 years between Chilcot and the civil service and Downing Street, they've decided better to do a deal, get something out there, get the inquiry out there. I suspect what it will tell us is that Tony Blair committed himself so far to George Bush that there was no turning back, and that there's documentary evidence that he basically says, whatever you want to do, George, is fine by me. You know, whether he put it in those words or not. And therefore, in a sense, it didn't matter what the British cabinet said. It didn't matter what the British parliament said, because Blair had already committed himself to Bush. That's my personal view of what will come out.
Although, James Schneider, there's an argument that even if the conversations did say that, it makes no difference. There was a vote in the British Parliament. It wasn't Tony Blair who led Britain into war. It was a vote in the UK House of Parliament, and MPs voted about whether Britain was going to go to war or not. Whether, you know, whether Blair had made a promise to Bush or not, if he'd lost the vote, he would have lost the vote.
I think that's only true up to a point and not that large of a point. I mean, what's important is what was the information that was provided to MPs, to Cabinet and to the British public for the reasons for going to war, when going to war was actually decided upon that they were going to do it versus when everyone was told that was going to happen. And the intelligence failings or deliberate lies, the level of high level communication and when things were planned, I think is extremely important, because that information wasn't put before Parliament and that information was not put before the British people before the war was decided. And so it's all very well and good saying, well, you know, Parliament did vote for it, but they didn't vote for it in the full knowledge, which is why so many of them have been able to say subsequently, if I had known now what I knew then. Oh, the way around, if I knew.
I want to ask you both a question. I don't want to ask you whether you were for the war or against the war, but I want to ask you this. Stuart Purvis, is there anything you think you could read that would make you change your mind about whether you thought it was a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I think there is, yeah.
You still think your mind, 11 years on.
I'm such an open mind. Now, look, it goes back to the intelligence. And to be honest, if intelligence, there had been intelligence which was more soundly based than what we know of, I'm sure we would have been told by now. But one ought to keep an open mind if something's going to be produced. But it doesn't sound like that's not the missing element in this report. The missing element of the report is, in a sense, goes to what there was a report already called the Butler Report, which was very critical of the way Tony Blair...
And this point pointed out that there were only five actual human intelligence sources inside Iraq. Three of them said, we don't think he's got anything. And the two that said he did turned out to be not very trustworthy people.
Indeed, but I think the point that goes to what we may find out, or may or may not find out from the next stage, is just exactly how Blair managed his own colleagues. Did he mislead his own colleagues? I think that could be interesting. That goes to your point, potentially, in a sense that if his colleagues were misled, then Parliament was misled. I think that's still a thread that's worth looking out for.
And James Schneider, I mean, the same question to you. Is there anything that you could hear, read, see that would make you change your mind on whether you thought the war was a good thing or a bad thing?
I think given how long it's been, if anything emerged that would suggest it was a good thing, my first response would be to look at that information extremely critically, how it's come about and why didn't it emerge beforehand, before my mind would be changed. I mean, it would take that evidence being extremely robust to believe it, given how flimsy exactly, as you've been saying, what happened before.
We will leave it there. I'm sure we'll be talking about this much more when the report actually comes out. Let's move on to Nigeria. President Goodluck Jonathan has announced today that we will reinforce our defence, free our girls and rid Nigeria of terrorists. That was a speech to mark Nigeria's Democracy Day. James Schneider, interesting words. It's... there's very little action that's likely to back that up, though, isn't there?
He's lost all credibility. He's already said that Boko Haram will be entirely defeated by April. He's said beforehand that Boko Haram will be entirely defeated by, you know, date X, Y. We will, of course, get them back. We will, of course, defeat the scourge. We will, of course, do this, that and the other. And it really doesn't appear to be backed up by a, you know, fully coherent plan for how to deal with Boko Haram, or even a public or open discussion about what the strategy has been. So if you look at the state of emergency in the three northeastern states and the creation of the joint task force and that phase of the attack, you can say that that has led to more deaths, but it has localized where Boko Haram are. They can attack in, apart from, of course, the two recent attacks in Abuja and one in Plateau State, it's localized where they can be. And that could be an argument. They could say, we have lost this, but we've gained that. But there is no openness in the discussion of the strategy. And one just gets the unpleasant feeling that Goodluck Jonathan still thinks this is in some way politically motivated against him and isn't quite the serious problem that he has to deal with.
And Stuart Purvis, incredibly difficult for Western governments to work out what sort of support they can give. It's all very well for David Cameron to hold up a piece of paper saying, bring back our girls. But
it now goes bigger than that with, Obama sort of reinventing a foreign policy, which is basically around supporting nations in this kind of situation which Nigeria has given, just in case we thought America had gone completely isolationist. But I mean, the thing that fascinates me is the public relations handling of this, because I know of a British firm which has been, certainly I don't know if they're still advising him, but I couldn't imagine the conversation now between people here saying, you better say this and you better say that. And you always get the feeling that he's reluctant to almost play the game here. Just comes up with these occasional statements that don't amount to much, and they don't amount to much in action either. So it's a kind of double whammy of a man who doesn't look like he's doing anything and actually a man who actually cannot point to anything very concrete that he is doing.
And James, just briefly before we go, you've just been in Gabon at the rather oddly named New York Forum Africa, held in Libreville. They've been trying to sort of market this as an African Davos. Lots of politicians from around the continent, lots of business people, a few journalists there as well. What were the big takeaways you got from it?
Well, most of the content that was on the stage, I think, was, although incredibly highly produced and incredible production values, lots of flashing lights and video recordings and music and catchy things and a dragon's den and ex-presidents and current presidents, the content was mainly superfluous. It was kind of a cover for what could go on around the sides, which was different people meeting. And it's called the New York Forum on Africa, but it's really about Gabon. It's really about what investment deals Gabon can get with the businessmen who turn up from around the world. It's not terribly African in terms of input from other African states at this point. I believe it's less this year than other years. Lots of good things were said, some not very good things were said, some things were omitted, like not that much discussion of human rights or democracy. And it was
in Gabon, a country with such great democracy, where the president's got the same name as the last guy who was president for 42 years.
Interestingly, total omission talking about father. No mention. There's very little of them going around. But I'll say one positive thing for it, which was that there were students who were in the audience, and they were by miles the most confident and critical people who asked questions. They did stand up and were not afraid to hold the ministers to account who were on the stage, and they basically showed everyone else up.
Brilliant. James Schneider and Stuart Purvis, thank you both for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op Londen, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots and lots still to come in the second half hour of Midori House. We're going to be in Athens. We'll also talk books with Mr. Bound. And there's also something about Brazilian soap operas and the World Cup. Who'd have thought? But first of all, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
And the top story is at least 14 people, one of them an army general, have been killed when a Ukrainian military helicopter was shot down near the eastern city of Slavyansk. Ukrainian officials say the aircraft, which was carrying soldiers on their way to replace colleagues, was shot down using a Russian rocket-propelled grenade launcher. A spokesman for militants in the rebel-held stronghold say they're claiming responsibility. Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has described the apparent honour killing of a woman by her family as totally unacceptable and has demanded action. Mr. Sharif has demanded to know why police apparently stood by while Farzana Parveen, who was 3 months pregnant, was stoned and beaten to death by her family in front of a Lahore court. Families of passengers on board flight MH370 say they've been left feeling helpless and angry after Australian officials announced recent acoustic pings came from a source unrelated to the missing aircraft. A US Navy official has claimed underwater signals detected in the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane came from a search boat or the ping detector itself. And provisional results from Egypt's presidential election show former military chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has won an overwhelming victory. Egyptian media is reporting he's gained more than 93% of the vote, with ballots from most polling stations counted. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for us to head to Athens for our daily check-in with one of our correspondents from around the world. And Natalie Savarakis is there in the Greek capital. Natalie, welcome to Midori House. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very good indeed. We're going to talk a little bit of culture in a moment, but first, the European elections obviously were big news in many European countries, but particularly in Greece, where Syriza, the radical left-wing party, topped the polls. What sort of reaction has there been in the past few days? Because it's had a bit of an impact on Greek politics, hasn't it?
Indeed. Well, not as big as one would have anticipated. And that's basically because although Syriza, the radical left, was victorious, it didn't really, I mean, its winning margin wasn't big enough to call for snap elections. As the leader had said, he had called this European elections referendum on the government's austerity policies and overall financial laws that it's been passing these past years. So what it has done, however, he's upped the pressure on Premier Antonis Samaras's coalition, very fragile coalition government. What Antonis Samaras is trying to do is to show that he is well received the message from the ballot box, that essentially the Greeks are not very pleased with the way he's been ruling the country for the past 2 years. And what we are seeing is a looming cabinet reshuffle. Now, it hasn't been announced officially, but it's been all over the Greek press. And of course, the prime contender to lose his job is the finance minister.
It's always the finance minister in Greece, isn't it?
Oh, yes, indeed. And Yanis Tournaras actually himself has denied and rejected all these accusations. But I can tell you that most Greeks here will be very happy to see him leave, because it will kind of like usher in a new period, even a new era for the government. Hopefully, with some signs of optimism there, although we all very well know that even though the finance minister can leave, it doesn't mean that the government's obligation to its international lenders will just be, you know, leave as well.
Indeed. Now, obviously, heading towards summer, it's already getting quite hot in Greece. And while that might be good for the tourist industry and for yourself, Natalie, if you can find your way to a beach, there are obviously problems that occur when the country gets so hot. And that's partly down to the risk of fire. Now, why is the risk of fire so great in Greece?
Well, for various reasons. First of all, when you get a heat wave, and Greece is prone to very dry vegetation and climate and drought, that triggers fires. And essentially in the month of August, we have the very famous, especially among sailors, Meltemi, which is a very strong wind. And this just feeds on the fire, and they rage out of control. And 2007, we had some very deadly fires that cost the lives of over 80 people from June to August. So Greece is always trying to be on standby for this, especially in the summer season. And what we had is the minister, Nikos Dendias himself, who came out saying that he's very worried, because it's been already so hot, that it might be another very dangerous season, especially in light of the fact that the country is undergoing a big financial crisis still and doesn't really have the money to buy all the necessary firefighting equipment.
And exactly. So there is a big problem with the firefighting equipment that's in Athens. I mean, and indeed throughout the country. How old is this stuff, and how much of a danger is it to Greeks if there are fires?
Well, I'll tell you what essentially the Nikos Dendias, the minister, said is that he needs 21 firefighting aircrafts, the Canadairs, the famous Canadairs that scoop water from the sea to just spray it on the fires. At the moment, we only have 11, and it's you know, the decrepit equipment. They don't have enough money to pay for firefighters, so they're very much going to rely on volunteer squads, he said. And at the end of the day, it's all down to money. He needs 350 million euros to upgrade all his equipment, money he just simply does not have.
Now, one thing that there is to look forward to in this summer in Athens is a bit of culture, a bit of ballet. And obviously, you've got some of the most incredible open-air amphitheatres in Athens. And there's a bit of a treat for theatre-goers heading there this summer, isn't there?
Yes, indeed. I'm afraid we'll have to wait through the summer, though. It just got announced. What we have is the artistic director of the Bolshoi Ballet for 30 years. He is the most celebrated living Russian choreographer, Yuri Grigorovich, and he is going to be staging two ballet premieres at a very famous ancient Greek amphitheater, the Odeon Herodes, and he's going to stage Spartacus and Giselle. Now, he's already staged other ballets here in the past 3 years, but Greeks are really looking forward to this one, because it's obviously going to be a premiere. And also, he is bringing in around 150 performers and soloists from Russia to participate in this. And they're going to have like specially made costumes for this and decor. So the Greeks are really excited about all this.
Brilliant. Well, let's hope it's a good one. Natalie Svarakis in Athens, thank you very much indeed. Up next here on Midori House, we're going to be looking at the World Cup and soap operas. 1839 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. And if there is anything that Brazilians enjoy more than football, if that were even possible, it's soap operas. However, there is a problem. Many soap fans might not exactly appreciate the World Cup rumbling into town. That's because most of the matches appear to be scheduled at the same time as the soaps. To help ease the pain, Globo, Brazil's main TV network, intends to air three-minute episodes of its 7pm soap, Gerachao Brazil. To talk to us about this, we're joined on the line by the Brazilian TV critic Tony Góes, and here in the studio, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Tony, welcome to Midori House. Three-minute soap operas, this sounds like a disaster. How are the soap fans of Brazil going to cope?
Oh, well, nobody knows, because this is going to be the first time such a thing is done with a telenovela in Brazil. Never before has a telenovela been suspended for the World Cup. So it's a bit of a gamble. Nobody knows how it's going to pay off.
And how much can you actually fit into a three-minute episode? Because I'll be honest, Tony, I've watched some of your soaps, and they seem to be quite melodramatic, and one sort of melodramatic argument lasts a lot longer than 3 minutes.
Yeah, well, actually, this is not a very melodramatic soap opera, because it airs at 7 p.m., which is considered a lighter time slot. So it's more a bit of a comedy. There is a little drama, but it's not something heavy like the famous Avenida Brasil. It's a different time slot, so it's more like a serialized sitcom. But anyway, it's a bit of a gamble to suspend it for 2 whole weeks.
Indeed.
The first phase of the World Cup.
A gamble indeed. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with us in the studio.
Hello.
Are you worried about what's going to happen?
I'm worried because, you know, Steve, honestly, I think Brazilians, they love soap operas as much as football. And in fact, I've read somewhere that when they show a match on TV, I mean, the audience is not that high. I mean, it's the same as if they played a soap opera. So, and then I think there's been some discussion, maybe, I don't know if Tony's going to agree with me, that Globo will put the episodes online. But I probably this wouldn't be the right decision, because even though Brazilians are increasingly online, watching TV online, it's still, I mean, for the average, I don't know, housewife, 60-year-old in the Northeast, probably she wouldn't go to her computer to watch the soap opera. That's
maybe
just
not
an example.
We're going to hear a little bit of one. Tell us what we're about to listen to, Faye.
Well, we're going to listen a clip from Geração Brasil. I want actually us to listen and then I'll explain
okay.
What's going on.
Excuse me, please.
Hi, sweet darling.
Excuse me, I don't have time for that.
Darling! Os jornalistas já estão de plantão, my darling!
Really?
There we are. What do we make of that, Fernando?
It does need some explanation,
yeah.
Because it's a very, may I say, exotic soap opera.
So you can basically, say exotic, yes.
Well, you know the character was saying, darling, darling, her name is Dorothy, because actually the soap is based in three different cities, in the US, in the Silicon Valley, in Rio, and in Pernambuco. And Dorothy actually is a transgender character, and she's going to meet her friend Pamela Parker, which is half Brazilian, half American, a former 90s kind of a actress, and she's in a bath with a lot of petals, you know, and there's a lot of paparazzi outside, including a crazy Korean journalist, and then they sit by the cameras in the bathroom. It's very interesting, very very interesting, and I agree with Tony. This is, I mean, there's some drama, but it's more kind of a funny, very fast paced soap opera, and it talks about technology.
Okay, Tony Góes, faced with the choice between watching the soaps or watching the football, where would most Brazilians, if they had to make that choice, what would they go for?
That's a good question, because what happened is Globo, the big TV network, they chose to air as many games as possible. That's why they are suspending the soap opera. But that means they are going to show games of little interest to the average Brazilian. Things like Iran versus Croatia or whatever. So it's really a risky gamble. Nobody knows how it's going to pay off.
Indeed, Fernando.
I really don't know.
No, exactly. As you say there, you know, the faced with the choice between Honduras versus Switzerland or the latest episode of Geração Brasil, most go for the soap, aren't they, Fernando?
Well, I'm sure I will be watching Geração Brasil instead of that. I want to say something else as well, because Globo, I mean, they have such a fixed schedule. I would say even compared to channels like BBC, they really don't change the times of the soap operas. There's the 6 p.m., 7 p.m., 9 p.m. soap opera. I think this is the first time ever that they are changing so much. In fact, there's a little pre-soap opera at 5:30, which is going to be cancelled during the World Cup. And that's quite shocking news.
Indeed. Shocking news indeed. We're going to leave it there. Tony Goes, thank you very much indeed. Fernando, thank you too. We're going to play some music though. And Fernando, you're going to tell us what this is.
It's the main song of the soap opera Geração Brasil, and it's called País do Futebol, the country of football. And this is MC Guimê. A desnutrição e hoje vai dominar o mundo no flow. Por onde a gente passa é show, fechou. E olha onde a gente chegou. Eu sou país do futebol, negou. Até gringo sambou, tocou Neymar, ego. No flow, por onde a gente passa é show, fechou. E olha onde a gente chegou. Eu sou país do futebol, negou.
MC Guimê with País do Futebol on Monocle 24, as chosen by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Up next, we're looking at books. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Before we end the show, time for a little bit of a review of sorts.
I like the way you sort of sounded as if you put that in inverted commas.
Review.
We're going to have a review, Rob. We think you've had quite a good year. But,
not a staff review, but a books review. And Robert Bound, Monocle's culture editor, is here. Hello,
hello.
Rob.
Hi.
We're going to look at some books that you've been reading.
We are. That's going to be the essence. We're really going to go off piece today. And under the auspices of a book review, we're going to talk about three books that I've read.
Excellent.
So let's start. Should we start with Mark Ellen's memoir called Rockstars Stole My Life?
Now, Mark Ellen was the editor of, was it the editor of Word magazine?
He was the editor of The Word. He was the editor and founder of Mojo. He worked at Smash Hits. He worked at The Enemy and Melody Maker. He is a Zelig-like figure in the music industry and writing about music. He did everything from almost get beaten up on his first assignment, reviewing a gig by Elvis Costello. Costello and the Attractions in 1977 by Elvis Costello's manager.
Oh, really?
Yeah. To being one of the helmsmen of Live Aid in 1985, the TV behemoth that changed the world of TV and music as we know it, and was one of the presenters of the Old Grey Whistle Test on BBC Two. He deputised for John Peel on Radio One, and he went on to launch and edit some of the most, well, the best music magazines in the world.
So basically, he knows what he's talking about.
He knows what he's talking about. And the book is an amazing... The book is a real sort of rip-roaring ride. He's a very sympathetic writer. He's very amusing. He writes some sort of beautiful pen portraits of certain characters, which were his heroes and which turned out either they might still be or maybe they aren't at the end of it. Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin and notably Rod Stewart. There's a very amusing chapter on following Rod Stewart around Milan, trying to get an interview with the old codger, which is very good, and it's lovingly done. He's not kind of spilling the beans. He's not the kind of rock writer like Nick Kent, whom he writes about, actually, because he shared an office with him at the NME. Nick Cooler Than Keith Kent, as he was known in those days, you know, who kind of boasted about being able to take as much heroin as Keith Richards and saving his life and all the rest of it. He's a magnanimous figure, and he's there to document the times rather than being up to his elbows in the times, if you get my meaning.
So this is essentially written by someone who, as we say, knows what he's talking about, was there, but also it's written with love about music that he loved and people that he loved, who he thinks created great music.
Yeah, exactly. It's a loving memoir
interestingly for us as well, I mean, about the music and about the musicians, but also about the publishing industry. It's a fascinating thing. As you said at the beginning, he is the editor of The Word, set up. When was it set up? In the early noughties, I suppose, or maybe the late 90s, and it no longer is with us. It was my favourite music magazine ever, actually.
It was fantastic.
It was really, really smart. But it was interesting, him talking about the reasons why he thought that might have failed and all the rest of it, and the challenges of the digital age and all the rest of it.
You look at the things he wrote for. Enemy still exists, just. Smash Hits doesn't exist anymore. Q sort of exists.
Q was the sort of big publishing behemoth.
Select certainly doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. Mojo's gone.
Mojo still does pretty well actually, because it's the only one, you know. Mm. But yeah, so he's very interesting on sort of publishing and on that. But he's more interested in telling these stories of what it was like to have to stand in for John Peel, and then John Peel turning up halfway through his session because he didn't want to get, you know, he thought the BBC were forcing him out because he was, you know, he was always sort of clinging on by his fingernails. He felt at the BBC, and Mark Allen having to sit in that none more hot seat than John Peel's in that late evening slot on Radio 1 in the early 80s and stuff. It's a fantastic book. And as I say, it's worth reading if you want to hear about all these stories or if you just have a sort of passing interest. As I say, he's the kind of person that's cropped up at every important moment in music for the last sort of 40 years. So it's a super cool read and a very lovingly dealt with kind of portrait of a life in music too.
The book is called Rockstars Stole My Life by Mark Allen. Let's talk about The Forgiven by Lawrence Osborne.
Yeah, so I did this book review slot a couple of weeks ago, and I talked about Lawrence Osborne's latest book, which is out now, which is out a couple of weeks ago, in fact, which is called The Ballad of a Small Player, about a sort of fake lord who decides to gamble himself and drink himself, you think perhaps to death in the casinos of Macau. Anyway, so this is, and I thought I've got to check out a bit more Lawrence Osborne. This was the book he wrote before it, or the novel he wrote before it. It's called The Forgiven. It follows a couple who are driving through Marrakesh, driving through Morocco to go to a house party in a castle on the edge of the Sahara Desert, and it is about how the bourgeois international jet set come up against the locals and against particularly the people that you might that we're suspicious might be Islamic terrorists, or certainly people that are not really attuned to and have much and have give short shrift to the Western way of life, as in these crazy hedonistic drug and orgy parties in the middle of the desert. So it's about this, and it's about the fact that on their way they drive on the, and this happens right at the beginning of the book, they're driving through the desert and they knock over and kill a sort of 17-year-old Moroccan boy on the road, and it's about how they deal with that and all the rest of it. And it's a fantastic book. It's completely different to the novel he wrote immediately afterwards, the one which I spoke about 2 weeks ago, but it's amazing. And he's a wonderful writer, and he's a great discovery. So I will nerdle on about him when I've just read his book that he's written before. So I will keep on recommending.
Keep delving back into the.
I'm going back to the catalogue. I'm going to make like Marty McFly and keep going back to the future.
Do you find that when you read someone's new book and then you go to read an old book, sometimes there's that danger that they've got better as they've grown older, and so actually you go back to read their old stuff. You go, it's good, but it's not great.
Well, I always used to, I mean, with novels, I think it's a really good point. I always used to do this when I used to buy records. It'd be like, oh, you know, Neil Young, he's the godfather of grunge. He's just come out, but I want to buy his first album, not his last one. Do you know what I mean? So that I do it in order. With this, I guess I got sent this book, The Ballad of a Small Player, to review it. And then I'm kind of working my way backwards under my own steam.
Excellent. Well, in 2 weeks' time.
And I'm still ploughing a very rich furrow.
Good. We'll ask you about that.
The next one. It needed to be, really, didn't
it? Finally, The Tottenham Outrage by M.H. Bayliss, which isn't anything to do with football, is it?
This isn't about sacking Tim Sherwood.
No.
This isn't about, why are Arsenal so much better? speak to Tom Edwards about that. This is the second novel, or the second in a series of crime detective fiction from M.H. Bayliss, who is a new British writer. The Tottenham Outrage is set in that part of North London. And it's the second novel in the Rex Tracy series. Rex Tracy is a reporter on a local newspaper. Again, there's a little bit of the interesting niceties of sort of publishing in this. It used to be the Wood Green Gazette, and now it's called newsnorthlondon.co.uk. It's no longer, it kind of comes out as a yeah. cursory piece of paper, but essentially it's a website. And he is investigating, or he's trying to write a story on, and then ends up investigating this mysterious series of deaths within the Hasidic Jewish community in Tottenham, of which there are many. And so it's this thing of him not knowing, of him being a Roman Catholic and sort of investigating this thing. And it's not really about it's not necessarily about the comedy of difference. He's just, like a lot of detectives, he's a bit of a baggy character who's keen on a six pack of Polish lagers and a dry one-liner. And it's a very good book. And it was one of those things that it's published by Old Street Publishing, an outfit that send lots of books review, and more than we can possibly handle, actually. And this is a great thing. So it's kind of nice to give it some airtime. And it's a really good book. I'm reading that right at the moment. So I will review it properly, maybe in a couple of days' time. But it's a really good book that I'd recommend. And Rex Tracy is an amusing dick. You can call that a flatfoot.
You can. And also nicely some. Good old-fashioned sense of London detective novels that, you know, detective novels don't just have to be based in Sweden or Norway or Denmark.
No, indeed. Yeah, and exactly. And this part of, you know, this part of North London is more foreign a country to many of our listeners and to me than perhaps Copenhagen or Sweden or Stockholm is, actually. So that's a good book. That is The Tottenham Outrage by M.H. Bayliss. It's not out yet, but I think it's out in a month's time.
Okay, so. I'm sure you can order it at those sort of online things where people order things these days.
Yeah.
The other books were The Forgiven by Lawrence Osborne and Rockstars Stole My Life by Mark Allen Rotbaum. Thank you very much.
My very great pleasure.
And that is that for Midori House. Thank you very much to all my guests, whether that was Tony Goege, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Natalie Savarakis, Rotbaum, and of course, Stuart Purvis and James Schneider. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alex May. The studio manager was Bill Luty. Coming up after the headlines with Bill Bingham, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Do stay tuned for that. The Monocle Daily, of course, is at its normal time, 2200 hours. That's a little bit later tonight. Midori House is back again at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours if you're listening on the East Coast. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.